At Cool Air Products, we developed AC Smart Seal Quick Shot with professionals in mind. It's the only product on the market that's 3-in-1, with sealant, lubricant, and UV dye all in a single application. It's non-toxic, non-flammable, 100% safe to the touch, eco-friendly, and compatible with all refrigerants. It's a safe solution option, backed by years of R&D, Intertech tested, and has sealed millions of leaks. AC Smart Seal, the professional's choice.
What's up, guys? Welcome back. We have another live. This is from the Heat Pump Symposium in Toronto, Ontario in 2023. This is the third of the series. You probably listened to a couple others late last year. So we have Chris Battersby from Bats Can Marketing. We have Matthew Reed from EnviroAir Industries and Mukhtar Malawiya. I think I pronounced that right. He's the president of Kane Canada. And we're going to have this conversation around heat pump install and startup live on the scene. Let's get to it, guys. This is the HVAC Know-It-All podcast. I'm your host, Gary McCready. This podcast is sponsored by Master, and one of the cool initiatives they have going is they donated a bunch of equipment to Mohawk College for their heat pump training course, Move Air Fujitsu York. And I was part of that last Friday and got to see what the students were up to. These are apprentices and licensed technicians going back for, what do you call it? I think it's called micro training or something like that, where it's a few modules of training online or in book and then in the shop. So it's a very cool training and I was glad to be part of it. Check out master.ca. This podcast is sponsored by Cintas. Cintas provides uniforms for the blue collar trades through their website. So if you're looking to outfit your team with some clothing coming up for the spring here, some spring jackets, pants, t-shirts, hoodies, you name it, check out cintas.com/HVAC know-it-all.
I mean, when it comes to the install of a heat pump, generally speaking, it's the same traditional install practices. But what we're doing now with a lot of systems is we're integrating a heat pump with a boiler or a furnace. We're creating dual fuel systems. We're creating electric heat backup. So it's not just the same old. We're implementing different things within. And Matthew, I know you're a big hydronics guy. So I'd like to talk to you and get your opinion on the whole dual fuel aspect rather than a heat pump that has electrical backup.
Yeah, love to. So that's the kind of cool thing about the heat pump in general is that it is going to do the vast majority of your heavy lifting for about 90% of your season. And that's really where you're going to find your most amount of cost savings. But because we are in Canada, we still are going to hit those deep, cold temperatures, and that's where your backup heat is going to come in. And what makes a heat pump so unique is you have your air-to-air, and you also have your air-to-water, and I'll kind of focus on air-to-water for the first bit of this, is that your air-to-water you can really incorporate nicely with a boiler or the electric backup because you can get your heat emitters into that low-temperature range, and that's where heat pumps really shine. Low temperature, constantly sipping on energy, but just little bits at a time, and the auxiliary fuel coming in just to top up when you need it. Because as the heat load in your house changes, as the temperature outside drops or rises, but primarily when it drops, that's when you need that backup, and that's when you can really kind of kick in that extra bit of heat. It just is such a harmonious partnership for higher efficiency gas or electric or heat pump or whatever. Low temperature is just kind of where the sweet spot really is.
For sure. Now, I mean, if we're going to go dual fuel, we obviously have to run a gas line from whatever propane, natural gas from the street. And Chris, this is where you come in because you rep a very unique product in the corrugated stainless steel tubing market. And I'd just like to have you speak to sort of the advantage of using corrugated stainless steel over perhaps black iron or copper in certain instances. Because we've discussed, you and I, about, yes, it might be a little bit more expensive to purchase the materials, but the labor savings down the road when you're doing big projects or even small projects in some cases, you come out on the winning end, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And that was kind of, as I mentioned, I go all the way back for 20 whatever years. And when we first brought Gastite into the province, I mean, we're the third manufacturer in here, we were 5.5 times the cost of soft copper at half inch. So crazy expensive. And every guy that we showed the product to go, that's really cool, how much is it, can you bury it? And they just walk away from you when you told them what kind of price we were talking about. So what we did was we gave a ton of it away. And we'd go onto a job site, train the installer, give them no charge product, do the whole, they call it the trial project program, and let the guys just decide, okay, if I spent this stupid amount of money on this product, would the job still have been profitable? And pretty much everybody that we did those trial projects with continued to use it. And that's why you've seen CSST in general, not just Gastight, sort of just push copper and black iron out of most areas of the industry. It's not a perfect product. I mean, there are areas where black iron makes good sense that would use over CSST. Any area where there's a potential sort of puncture or mechanical threat, or rooftop areas where you've got windows looking down on the roof, because CSST is flexible, so it's not as pretty and straight. So there are areas where, you know, a more traditional piping might make sense, but in general, if you're not using CSST, you're hurting yourself financially. It's as simple as that. You're paying way more money for your materials than you would, although those become closer depending on what's going on with commodities. But the labor advantage is massive, and that's really where it started to change. The number of guys you have to send on a job site, the leak potential, because you only have fitting on either end. There's a lot of advantages that have really kind of displaced traditional black iron and copper piping out of the market for the bulk of the market.
Mm-hmm. And obviously with a gas-fired appliance, Mukhtar, we need to do, when we start this thing up, at some point, it's always best to do a combustion analysis on the appliance. So we have a kind of a day one, just readings of the day one performance. So over time, when we go back with our analyzer once a year, twice a year, we can see if there's any deviation from that day one performance and correct it before it comes a real issue, right?
No, absolutely. One of the biggest things is the contractor should be doing the combustion analysis right from startup and having printouts or recorded results where they have comparison for those deviations as well. Looking at what your install and service manual requires you to test for, CO2, CO, excess air efficiency, what your flue temperatures are, those are the key things that most contractors record, or your startup sheets request you to fill out, including your gas pressures and just an overall analysis so you know the system's operating efficiently after install. Having done your install and not doing any adjustments or any combustion testing becomes very difficult when most customers just say it was set at factory, but it's not set for your elevation or your environment. So you don't know if the equipment's operating efficiently without a combustion analysis.
Yeah, 100%. And as far as the combustion analysis goes, what do you recommend? Do you recommend once a year, twice a year? What do you recommend for that appliance? Is it all dependent on how often it runs? Like if you have a long winter compared to or versus a short winter?
Yeah, no, it recommended is once a year.
Okay.
Most appliance manufacturers will tell you that. Where I find the most difficulty is getting the guys to even do the combustion testing, testing once a year.
I was going to ask you about that too. How many techs are you finding are actually doing this on startup?
Well, what it comes down to for them to claim their warranty, to register that, then they'll do the testing. Otherwise, it's, it was done at factory, install and walk away. Mm-hmm. And so the industry, I guess, standard has become you got to test it at least once a year, or if you have a service contract with that customer wherever you've installed the appliance, you're doing your once a year testing and you can see your deviations that way. But you need to get people into that realm of you got to test.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest thing I keep saying is it's a guess if you're not testing. You're guessing if you're not testing.
Oh, yeah. I say that all the time. I don't know where I heard it, but yes, if you don't. I forget who said it to me, but once, like, if you don't test, you don't know.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
It's just a guess. It's like licking your finger and putting it in the air.
Sounds good.
So within the realm you're in of design and stuff, Matthew, when it comes to the way people are piping in their boilers and the stuff that the equipment that you spec and sell, how are you seeing contractors utilizing a product like corrugated stainless steel in an install where it just makes more sense as far as the labor cost to do it that way?
Yeah, so these whole systems as a whole have become a bit more of a expensive piece, and we're seeing a lot more hybrid approaches to a lot of our installs. And when we're seeing that hybrid approach, we're seeing multiple heat sources coming together. So when we talk about, and I just want to quickly touch on something that you mentioned here with the combustion analysis and the warranty, first and foremost, that one there is a great point, because if you don't get these pieces installed properly the first point and run your combustion analysis, run your manometer for your drop test, that can and does affect your warranty first and foremost. And if you don't get these things right, you're not going to get the full warranty allowance that the manufacturers will allow, such as an extended labor warranty or something like that. Now, on the CSST side of things, which again, I'm a huge proponent, it makes all the sense in the world. Number one, because it's become a tremendous amount faster, and in order for us to hit our housing crisis, you know, we got to build houses faster, we got to build them better. CSST is a great piece for incorporating into that one, and we can do a lot more with that because of the versatility, where we have our one, you know, branch coming in from the meter at, for example, 1.25 inch black pipe or whatever it's going to be, and then you take off of all those pieces to your natural gas appliances or propane or whatever it is, you can get in and out with the job a whole lot faster, get it piped in, make your money, and get paid, stay paid, provided that you finish up with testing, making sure that, okay, I ran 100 feet of CSST with all appliances firing, am I getting the pressure drop that I need at the boiler, yes or no, or whatever appliance. And so these whole pieces are designed to work together in harmony, where you got to install it properly, test it accordingly, and then it'll work together as a design package. All the pieces have to fit.
Supplyhouse.com in the US is a very good option for ordering parts and tools for your HVAC, mechanical, electrical jobs. They have all kinds of stuff within their store. Distribution centers across the U.S., so it doesn't take forever for the parts or the tools to get to your door or your job site. So if you're looking to up your game with some online e-commerce stuff for your HVAC jobs, check out supplyhouse.com.
Yeah, for sure. And one step further on the corrugated stainless steel front is a discussion that you and I have had, Chris, and I didn't even know existed until recently when we started to talk a lot more, is the FlashShield Plus, and how there's less bonding requirement around that product, because basically we can use it to bond our equipment as long as the equipment somewhere goes back to a ground source at some point electrically, right?
Exactly, and that is a direction that this market is going to go. In the US, we haven't sold yellow CSST in the US for almost 7 years, and I think track pipe was even earlier than that, like 10 years. So it is the direction that we're going to go here in this market as well. And of course, it's a little bit more expensive, the actual pipe. Everything else is all works together. You don't have to change anything else. The assembly is the same. All the benefits are the same. But the two most taggable offenses and the biggest pain in the backside for any installer is bonding and incidental contact with other metallic building systems. Because it's flexible and easy to install, it's like installing electrical conduit instead of gas pipe, guys get carried away and they don't care what it's touching up against, it looks like crap. The yellow pipe had issues in the US, in particular in the lightning belt, so that if you had a lightning strike, you had the potential to arc through from another metallic building system and blow a hole through the pipe. Now you've got a standing pilot. So there's all kinds of lawsuits, et cetera, that went on, and the manufacturers went after protecting them from lightning. And so in Canada, we have been bonding gas piping systems forever, and they still require to be a bonded system.
Yeah.
In the case of FlashShield Plus, because of all the multiple layers, it's not only lightning proof, but it requires no bond because it has absolute continuity of the way that the pipe and fitting assemble. So the two big taggable pain in the back or backside offenses for a installer go away with FlashShield Plus, and that's where you're going to see this market go. Mm-hmm. It's the safest product there is out there, and you're reducing your costs with regard to bonding clamps, bonding wire, which is a minimum of $1 a foot if you're buying a lot of it. All those things are starting to stack up. So you're going to see that transition in this market, and it's the present in the U.S. It's going to be the future in Canada, and we're definitely going that way.
Where's the market you feel right now compared to the U.S.? You said the U.S. has been doing it for over 7 years. Where are we with it? In Canada.
Yeah, so I can only really honestly speak to my specific product, and in Ontario, I know that we're around the 20% mark already, and that's just the beginning, mm-hmm. for sure.
So let me take this conversation back to the heat pump itself. So a lot of technicians that are out there and I wish there was more discussion about this here, and hopefully we will next time we do these, is install practices, things like bending pipe, brazing with nitrogen, trying to reduce your fittings where you can. But one thing that's super important with installing an air conditioning system, refrigeration system, but it's going to be really important with a heat pump, is pulling a proper vacuum on that heat pump. Now, Kane sells, yeah. Kane UEI sells Micron gauges.
Correct.
Right? Okay, so, I mean, you can maybe help me along with this here, Mukhtar, but pulling a vacuum down to 500 microns, below 500 microns, making it hold there to ensure that we don't have any off-gassing, any frozen water that's vaporizing within the pipe, making sure that vacuum comes down and stays there is going to prevent any moisture buildup or any moisture residual in the system. And I say that with importance because a heat pump, cold weather heat pump, is going to be running outside.
Correct.
When it's sub-zero. So when that thing shuts off for any reason, the thermostat's satisfied, and we have moisture in that system,
that moisture is going to freeze.
The moisture could potentially freeze.
Absolutely.
And when the heat pump goes to start up, if that moisture is in a small capillary tube, a small valve, it's going to create a blockage.
Correct.
And it's not going to fix itself until it thaws out. So you could see intermittent problems. You could have a technician there one day going, scratching his head, it's working fine, but
correct.
It wasn't working fine at the hour before they got there. And it comes back to install practices, and one of the things is pulling a proper evacuation.
Yeah, and that's something that I keep talking about in the whole test and install process, is are guys actually doing it? With systems coming pre-charged, everybody just adds line set and away they go, and the only time it gets evacuated correctly and they check for a vacuum is when they're doing service work on it. Biggest thing is pulling a vacuum, getting it down to 500 microns or less, and making sure that it's holding vacuum. And it can range from anywhere from 5 minutes to 20 minutes to see if it's holding its vacuum.
Because depending you make on the sure, size of the system.
Correct. Yeah. You want to make sure there's no moisture in there, because as you were saying, it can freeze up, and we already know refrigerants and moisture do not mix. And now when you have it in the system where it can freeze up, especially in a cold climate like ours where you're using heat pumps, it will cause blockages. And by the time they get the system running, when the contractor's there, like you said, he's there scratching his head because the system's running again. Might not be running efficiently, but it's running. And it's one of those things, it's not done correctly from the get-go, you just have more faults down the line and more difficult to pinpoint.
Not only do you have more faults down the line, if you are not able to pull that refrigerant, pull that vacuum properly here the first time, and you do have any moisture in the system, these new heat pumps with inverter technology, you can't just use your gauges to figure out what was wrong. These are all way in, way out refrigerant technologies, where you're talking about if you have any problems with that refrigerant in the line, the whole charge needs to come out, and in most cases, well, at least in some cases, that refrigerant is now obsolete, needs to be destroyed. You then need to pull your vacuum down to 500 microns or less, and I don't think any of us could stress strongly enough, or less is probably the better idea. And then everything needs to be weighed back in all together. So your service call has gone from just hooking up your gauges and seeing what's what, to now completely removing the charge, then pulling the vacuum, praying that it holds, and, you know, light a candle and pray. And then when you see it even rise just a little bit, you know, you're still not there yet. You have to keep on pulling that vacuum. It's become quite the challenge.
Yes.
Because these heat pumps do require such minute requirements in the system, any sort of moisture in that on the heating or cooling.
Correct.
That's it, man. Game over. And it's a lot of money to change the refrigerant every time you put it back in there.
Agreed. And it comes down to, again, having the tools, having your vacuum pump, having your recovery unit, having your micron gauge, and not just relying on your gauges, because your gauges just don't tell the story anymore. Whether it's a digital gauge or an analog gauge, it won't tell you the story. You can't see any ripple effects or anything like that. You essentially have to evacuate the system and start fresh.
Yeah, that's a problem that I actually get that question a lot from technicians, is how do I adjust the charge of a heat pump in heating season, especially in an inverter system, because they're watching it and it's doing this. It's constantly moving around. And the only way to really do it properly is to pull it out and weigh it back in, right? Because it's really difficult to get your charge right in the heating season. It's easier to do it in the cooling season when the house is at its set point and it's 100 degrees outside Fahrenheit. It's easy to do it then. But in heating season, it's a lot harder. So it's a good point. Now, technology, like, it changes. Like, you with the gas, the Flash Shield Plus, I mean, that's technology advancing. As far as equipment or instrumentation to check and test these pieces of equipment, how is that advancing at the moment? Like, the digital gauges, digital manometers, combustion analysis, how are we advancing in that front right now?
So voltage monitoring and surge protection is really important. I've been talking about it now for quite some time. Rector Seal's got a kit, and it's all in one. It gives you both to protect pieces of equipment with expensive onboard electronics. RSH50 VRM kit. Check it out. It's a solution for surge protection and voltage monitoring.
So the biggest thing on the gauge side is one digital, so you're not looking at needles. But the big thing is you have one set of digital gauges for multiple refrigerants instead of having a gauge for R22 or a gauge for R410. Again, with like for the Kane product and UEI, we have what we call the hub. And it's individual pressure probes. You hook to the high side, you hook one to the low side, individual pipe clamps. And it calculates your superheat and subcool for you right on your screen. You're not using the old PT charts, which most people, I'm sure, don't even know how to use anymore or what it is.
Shane knows how to use a PT chart, right? Okay.
Yeah, it's one of those things of the past. They might touch on it on school nowadays. I couldn't tell you where they are with it. And you can have your psychrometric readings by using the probes that come with the hub as well. So you can get your temperatures, you can get your relative humidities of the system. So it's everything in the palm of your hand, and you can do a complete system analysis, which you couldn't do without actually pulling out a pad and paper and your calculator and doing the math before. Now the tool's doing it all for you. And also with the hub, you can calculate your target superheat, or it calculates it for you if you use an outdoor temperature sensor that gets embedded with the app itself. So there's more and more tools as tools develop that's out there to make the contractor's life easier. The thing is having the tool and doing what your analysis or your system requires right from install or service or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it all comes back to training. And your technology in GasTight that you represent, is that technology is bringing it up to another level. So training is really important. So what sort of training are you involved with GasTight right now to ensure contractors are installing it properly? And is it a requirement to buy it?
It is supposed to be, and for a long time, we even had secret shoppers going to distributors. And if we went to a distributor a couple of times anywhere in North America who just sold the pipe without asking for certification, we would literally shut them down.
Yeah.
And that has certainly diluted, but what we did was we made an agreement, both Doug Purdy from IPEX and us, because we used to do a lot of trainings together with TSSA, including training the TSSA guys, that every 3 years you're to renew. And so we have 9 people in the province, 7 full-time outside guys, and that's what we do. We do GasTight certifications and trainings at distributors, at all the colleges, at large enough contractors. We'll go sometimes 3 a day in 3 different cities for all those guys. So it is a major focus for us. Mm-hmm. So no matter whether it's my product or somebody else's product, if you're installing CSST in the market, you're supposed to be certified in that specific product. Because all they have in common is they're all corrugated stainless, so they're quick and easy to install. And there's a lot of differences thereafter. And so you need to know the specific product that you're installing. So we spend a tremendous amount of time with that. I just want to jump back to while I was listening to Mukhtar about some of the technology changes. One of the big ones for us, or for Kane, has been getting rid of the oxygen sensor in the combustion analyzer. That's a huge big deal that maybe you can
learn. No, absolutely. Because traditionally, all combustion analyzers have an O2 sensor and a CO sensor. And you can ask any contractor, what's the tool they hate? They'll name the combustion analyzer as the number one tool, because when it goes down, you don't know what it's going to cost you for service. Mm-hmm. And what Kane has done is they've used infrared technology to directly measure CO2. So you still have your CO sensor, but you have an infrared CO2 sensor where you calculate O2, and it's eliminated your oxygen sensor just going down whenever, because an oxygen sensor is a living sensor, so you don't know when it's going to die. You could be at a job at 8 in the morning and it's working fine. You go to your next job at, say, 10 o'clock, all of a sudden your analyzer is not working. Where with the infrared CO2 technology, it's always working.
Interesting.
And all you're doing is your annual recertification. And that's been a big benefit for Kane and the contractors out there, because we can offer what we call fixed rate service pricing with our Kane Care. A lot of companies, a tool like a combustion analyzer that is quite expensive is a capital investment. And so you know what your cost of ownership is just based on what your service rate is over the next 10 years. What we do with Kane Care is the instrument comes with 1 year warranty, manufacturer's warranty, and every year you send it in for recertification, we extend the warranty another year, all the way up to 10 years, as long as you're annually recertifying it.
Interesting.
And it's made a big difference in the industry. And just coming back to what you guys were talking about on training, and like Matthew said in the beginning, he goes around the country doing training. Training is a big part of this industry, because I go out and do training, teaching guys how to use the combustion analyzer. And a lot of times it's not just a Kane combustion analyzer or a UEI combustion analyzer, but at the end of the day, they spit out the results, what your CO is, what your CO2 is, oxygen, excess air, and just getting guys more comfortable with it. The biggest issue is it's a seasonal tool. So guys use it all winter, late fall, all winter, maybe in the spring, and then they forget about it. And then they switch to their gauges because they're doing air conditioning and vice versa. So they either forget features and benefits on how to use their tool, so you got to give them those reminders. But the other thing is, so they put their analyzer away come spring, and if it has an O2 sensor, you don't know if it's going to work when you go to fire it up in the fall again, come September, October. That used to be our biggest, busiest time of the year with combustion analyzer returns, because it was like, it's not working because it sat around for X period of time because it had an oxygen sensor. We've eliminated all that with the direct CO2 sensor, infrared CO2 sensor.
Interesting. I'm going to have to look more into that. I've never heard of that before. So Matthew, I'm going to come back to you. As far as the design stuff that you're involved in, what are you seeing from the customer base, your customer base, what they're wanting? Are they wanting hybrid systems with heat pumps, boilers? Like, what are you seeing nowadays when we transition to this kind of sort of heat pump landscape? How are they wanting to put these systems together from your perspective?
Yeah, so it's really an interesting answer to that question. And to be perfectly blunt, it's not so much that folks are asking for heat pumps. Heat pumps are the answer to their question. But the questions that they're asking is, how do I get off of oil and off of propane? Now, because those two have become quite expensive up in rural parts of Canada and throughout Ontario and whatnot. So that's kind of what we're seeing from a design point of view, is like, where are our other opportunities to get our heat sources from? Are they getting it from natural gas, from electricity? And that's where it kind of comes back to, as we really embrace a hybrid system, or you could have a 2, 3, 4 sources of heat going into a single system, but primarily it's all about, how do we get the most economical source of heat for our systems now? The systems that we're seeing now coming off of that propane and into electric or into natural gas, because natural gas is still the king of cost with regards to operation, if you will. And for what it's worth, I'm going to be very clear, I do not see this heat pump technology taking over the commercial sector for a good long time. Just around the door here, there's a 200,000 BTU heat pump, which is a absolutely stunning and beautiful machine, but it is the size of a pickup truck. Which is fine, you know, they got to be the size that they have to be for now. But a 200,000 BTU natural gas boiler is the size of a suitcase. So we're seeing now an interesting mix of getting off of expensive fuels, finding that solution with our best pricing of our heat source fuel being natural gas and our heat pump side of things, as we see natural gas continue to go up and electricity is actually kind of stabilizing. So that's what I see from the design point. It's not so much that they're asking for the heat pump, they're just looking for a solution from their current source to what's going to take me down the road in the future. Mm-hmm.
Well, just to add to what you're saying, like, I'm based out of Vancouver, and Vancouver, as of January 1st, did your any new build or retrofit, you're going to electric heat pump. And now it's come down to, well, you're starting to see a lot of hybrid systems because people just don't have the space for a monoblock heat pump, and it's like, where do you put it? When you have houses on 33-foot lots and your neighbor is an arm's length away,
yeah,
and you have to have a walkway down the side of your house, where do you put it?
Mm-hmm.
So you're starting to see a lot of hybrid systems coming out, and again, everything electrification in Vancouver.
And you know, like, they probably are going to get smaller. Technology's going to get better, and we're going to get smaller, and technologies are going to change, and our, holy smokes, in this symposium alone, there's three different types of refrigerants that we're showing up, or at least three. There's your CO2, your R34, your 410,
mm-hmm,
and there's probably a couple that I haven't stumbled across yet, but the technology is going to advance, and you know, the systems are going to change out in size, but I still firmly believe that our way forward should have been firm a while ago, and will continue to be moving forward, a hybrid system. And I really don't think that we should treat natural gas as, you know, the enemy here. It is it's an extremely clean fuel. It really is. So seeing it more like as an ally with our heat pump technology, which again, we could talk about refrigerant leaks all day long and have a completely different conversation about that. But it's an ally for our hybrid systems to all kind of come together. That's what we're seeing for designs right now.
Yeah, and the thing to add to that is that if you do implement dual fuel, you may not even use that natural gas very much at all.
Correct, 100%. Right? If we had another year like we had this winter, where we had the average winter temperature this year was like -2, you know, we had an extremely, this was actually the first year I continued to heat my home with air-to-air heat pumps throughout the entire season. I just never turned them off this year because I wanted to see. And I've never seen, well, I always had that doubt in my mind, and it's kind of like your tools, you know, these contractors need to trust their tools. Well, we need to trust our equipment as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And so if you use this as a dual fuel approach, you're right, you might not ever need to kick into the backup. However, though, when it does hit -35, you'll be awful glad when it's there.
I'm glad you said we need to trust our equipment, but as the title of this podcast, install and startup. If we don't install it properly and start it up properly,
agreed,
you can't trust your equipment at all. So that's why we need to train technicians on how to install properly, how to test properly,
correct,
how to design properly, and that's why I have all you three guys on here is to talk about this. So I guess that's it, guys. That's the discussion. So thank you guys very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Gary, really appreciate
it. Yeah, no problem.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Follow HVAC Know-It-All on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, Twitter, LinkedIn, and anywhere else Gary feels like popping up. This has been a Two Smokes and a Coffee production.